Well, I'm going to take my life in my hands and turn to 1 Samuel 17 with you. And a story that many of us have known for a very long time. I hope that you feel a little more alert than I do. And if not, of course, I'll find out in due course. And I spoke to my wife late last evening, and she said, "What do you have tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, I have five things tomorrow." And there was a pause, and she said, "Tell those people to leave you alone." I said, "No, it's not like that at all. It's a privilege." So, but this is a tough one. I remember being at the Strathpepper Convention years ago in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon, walking down the hill with T.S. Mooney, who was a little gentleman, a Presbyterian bank manager. You can imagine such a thing, from Derry. And he said, "I'll be tough this afternoon, you know." I said, "Why is that?" "Yes, Sunday afternoon, full of roast beef and unbelief." And I don't know, but this is about just as challenging as 10 to 5. Snakes alive, it's 10 to 5. All right. First time you're 17. And can I assume that you've got this? You will keep your Bible open. You look at it. Make sure that what I'm saying is there. Those of you who are tennis fans will rejoice in Wimbledon. It's one of the things I do miss, actually, about being in the States. The coverage of sport, from my perspective at least, is not as good. It's interrupted all the time. And most of the Wimbledon tennis matches come on time delay. And with the internet and everything, you usually know the results before you watch them if you can discipline yourself. And so something of a shine has gone off it. Most of a schoolboy, at least in England's life, is marked by Wimbledon, because you do your O-levels right at Wimbledon, you do your A-levels at Wimbledon, and so life goes. It's always such a challenge to get away from the television. But throughout the years, in watching all of those things, there are great tennis battles that remain in our minds, those of us who've watched them carefully. And there are also various incidents that have stood out, and none probably more graphic in its impact than one of John McEnroe's famous outbursts, where, remember, he took his racket and knocked the water glasses and smashed them all over the place and kicked a number of things, and all the time saying, "You can't be serious. You cannot be serious." He kept saying it again and again. And even after all these years, anytime I see him now, it's the only one thing that comes to mind. It's him kicking the daylights out of things, smashing all the things with his tennis racket, and saying, "You can't be serious." Well, I mention that because as I read this passage again, it struck me that the reaction of each of the individuals who is involved in a dialogue with David, the shepherd boy, might equally be prepared to have on their lips, in response to what they discover, McEnroe's famous phrase. "Surely this young fellow cannot be serious in doing what he's about to do." His arrival on the scene of battle, or if you like, on the scene of nothing, has introduced to the circumstances a missing note. Namely, he arrives introducing to the proceedings a concern for the glory of God's name. David immediately recognizes that there's more at stake in the scene before him than simply the fate of Israel and their wounded pride. It's quickly apparent to him that these individuals are sidelined by fear, and although they are routinely taking their place on the battlefield, that's all they're doing. And their perspective on the circumstance facing them is clearly skewed. And essentially, their predicament lay in the fact that they did not believe their beliefs. They did not believe what they believed. One of the things an elderly Christian said to me some years ago, and a good number of years ago now, but he told me, he said, "You know, you need to learn to doubt your doubts." And it seems that that's, I think, probably very helpful. And also, at the same time, we need to be exhorted to believe our beliefs. Let me just point out to you what I mean. These people largely believe that Yahweh is the living God. They would have said that. We believe that Yahweh is the living God. But they were standing on the battlefield and neutralized, acting as if he was dead. They believed that Yahweh was the Almighty. But they were acting as if he was powerless. They believed that Yahweh was a faithful covenant-keeping God, but they were acting as if he was indifferent. They believed that Yahweh was the deliverer, but they clearly had no expectation that he was going to deliver them. So they didn't actually believe what they believed. They had lost sight of God, and consequently lost heart for the battle. They were viewing the challenge that was facing them, and they were doing so from a purely human perspective. Just let me point out to you a number of verbs here that I think give us a picture of what's going on. They're randomly picked out. But first of all, in verse 20, where the record shows that early in the morning when David had left the flock with a shepherd, he loaded up and set out, just as Jesse, his dad, had directed. And he reached the camp as the army was going out to his battle positions, shouting the war cry. And he must have arrived and said, "Fantastic! Here I am, just in time for the national anthem. They're ready to go. Listen to them shouting, 'Here we go, here we go.'" Whatever they shouted, I don't know what they shouted. But then he said, all you do is shout? You mean you get all kitted up like this and then walk out there and shout?" If you go back to verse 11, the explanation is clear, because they were not only a shouting rabble, but they were a cowering crowd. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And you have this picture of them recoiling from the circumstances. The chap stands before them, he shouts out his challenge, and instead of advancing on the enemy, they cower in response. In verse 24, not only are they cowering, but they're running. When the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. A pathetic picture, actually. And in verse 28, we can add another little sideline to it with the verb arguing. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger. And he began to argue with someone who was actually one of his best allies. Actually, he was going to argue with the one who was going to prove to be his salvation. Now, the obvious thing, and maybe shouldn't miss the obvious, is that they were acting poorly because they were thinking wrongly. And when you and I are acting poorly because we're thinking wrongly,